Good evening. This is Jim Breeling. Welcome to our session. This is a very special and exciting session because our presenter was good enough to share her slides and material beforehand. I was able to, in turn, share that and get some questions and reactions from other people, and we're jumping up and down, and I have already a list of questions. So if you have listeners have questions here, please send them in right away so we can try to group them and organize them to cover the general focuses in the limited time we'll have at the end. Send your questions to neabpd@aol.com. So I said it stirred a lot of interest. As everyone, I think, knows, there's been very encouraging results about remission of symptoms of BPD, with it is going as high of over 80% down to 2 or fewer symptoms. Now, all the symptom criteria for DSM are in the moderate to highly severe range, so even having 2 is not great, but it's a tremendous improvement over 8 or 9. But the problem is that a great many people who are remitting are not going on to resume a general life with working and friends and ties, really recovery. And this is what Kate, in her most recent work, has been addressing with some very exciting results. Now, one of the nice things I got to tell you about doing these sessions, it takes time to get them together, but I'm always uplifted when I look back over the career and work of our presenters, and tonight Kate is no exception to that. She is involved with as a co-author or first author of more than 60 research papers over her career, in addition to being, I think most of the time, a pretty full-time clinician. So she has a very busy life. We could call her a successor to Freud, who does clinical work and also extensive research. She, in addition to her research and clinical work, she's also been very active and successful as a seeker for NIMH grants. She started out with a KO1 grant. This is a major research training grant. Very, very competitive. And it's really an investment in salary support and some support for research and people who, as an early young investigator, have demonstrated the clear potential for going on to make contributions. And Kay succeeded in getting that, and her subsequent work has showed that the review committee was absolutely right in its criteria for her. She has a small grant. She has an R34, which is one of the things that she's going to be talking about is early treatment research. She also has a major training grant on improving the mental health care and safety net medical settings, and she also got one of the last conference grants, R13, for development and dissemination of rigorous methods for training and implementation. A real problem. And to anticipate for several people here had questions, when could I get this treatment for my family member? And Kate can correct me, but I think so far it's only available in Seattle. And one of the issues that's going to come up is how to get high fidelity replication in various settings. If it's a drug or a surgical procedure or a piece of equipment, we have companies that make money and are very active in promoting the use and dissemination, and they're easy to, on the whole, to implement. But clinical treatment, psychotherapy, psychosocial interventions are much more difficult and challenging, and that's a major issue. Let me stop with that. Could rave some more about Kate, and we really appreciate her making the time and her schedule. The other thing, looking over all that she's done, I don't know when she sleeps. But let me turn over and get to the presentation because it is so meaty and so exciting. So, Kate, it is all yours.
Thank you very much. I'm hoping you all can hear me. If there's ever a point when people can't hear me, somebody please let me know, Jim or Perry. So I'm going to talk today. I believe people already have the slides, and I'll try to say next slide or something as I'm moving along to kind of make sure that we're all staying on the same page. So as Jim says, I'm at the University of Washington. I'm a psychologist in our medical school, and I have been running a DBT program there for a long time. And with my clinical team, we developed this treatment we call Accepting the Challenges of Exiting the System, or DBT ACEs. And what I thought I'd do is give you a little bit of background here on the overview slide about the context in which DBT ACEs was developed, a little bit about how it's different from standard DBT, and some considerations to think about in terms of individual therapy and coaching. And I'll present as we go a little bit of the pilot data that we have on this intervention so far. So my next slide, I'm from Seattle, and this is the slide after that is an acknowledgement of the support that this whole intervention has had. So this picture is a picture of the way up to our clinic with these nets on the left, which I think are supposed to be safety nets, although I think that's a stretch, but there it is. I also like to acknowledge the Center for Healthcare Improvement for Addictions, Mental Illness, and Medically Vulnerable Populations, or CHAMP, which is the center out of which we all do our combined research, and the Behavioral Research and Therapy Clinics, and Marshall and Hannah in particular for all of her support in pushing me and the treatment forward. So in this building with the safety nets is Harborview Outpatient Mental Health Services. So we are an outpatient mental health center. We're very similar to other mental health centers, except that we're attached to a large medical center that is owned by King County, which is the county where Seattle resides, and it's managed by the University of Washington. So everybody who is the kind of doctors, nurse, some of the senior nurses, psychologists, our faculty of the University of Washington, and the staff are also UW Washington clinical staff. So we are we meet kind of higher staffing than you would typically find in a community mental health center in Washington State. But in other ways, we're funded by the same mechanisms, Medicaid, Medicare, some commercial insurance in my program. So we have several different services, and you can see DBT is sort of one of a number of different services in a typical mental health environment. Sort of a brief history. At Harborview Mental Health Center, it's the first clinic outside of Marsha's clinic where she ever exported DBT in collaboration with a psychologist, Hugh Armstrong, who was at Harborview. And so it was really the first place it was ever tried other than her own clinic. And back in those days, they really were kind of constrained by a decision that got made in the 80s that sort of shifted particularly the West Coast and Washington State in a very biological direction in terms of treating people with severe mental illness, where the medications really became the core and psychotherapy was not considered a fundable service for people with severe mental illness being treated by Medicaid in the county. And so at that time, they did everything in groups, including sort of trying to come up with an individual therapy in group, which goes just as badly as you could imagine that it would. So in 1992, I arrived. I'd graduated with my PhD and was coming as a for a fellowship, and I came the same year as the most challenging set of clients that they had, and the group version of individual therapy, which had never worked that well, sort of completely fell apart. And at that point, we just decided that we were going to, we had to do one-on-one intervention, and we just billed it as case management. And they didn't argue with us, so we got kind of a more traditional model. And then I became a research therapist for Marsha at BRTC and realized that we were not being fully adherent. And so we really kind of made that our priority. And when Hugh Armstrong retired, I took over the team in 1996. And our immediate goal at that time was to become an adherent DBT program. And then, as you can see on the next slide, in, by 1998, we had an adherent program, but we had patients who we sort of thought of as, you know, kind of coming to be kind of stable mental patients. They weren't working. They weren't leaving the center. They weren't finding new friends. We tried adding another year of DBT. We just thought maybe these guys are kind of coming from a more difficult place to start with. Let's see if we added DBT. Didn't really help. And then kind of tragically in 1999, we had two patients who had worked with me and our team commit suicide. Both of them had completed DBT. Both of them were pretty stable. They were not going in and out of the hospital anymore. There was not a lot of crisis. But both of them were really suffering from kind of being lost, I think, in the world. And that year, both of them died, and we really just decided we had put in too much, and they were putting in too much for us to be satisfied with this level of recovery. And so it really became recovery from disability as our kind of mission as a DBT team. So we started developing DBT ACEs starting in 1999. We got a small grant in 2002 to kind of follow up and see what was happening, and we were able to analyze the data and discovered that DBT ACEs not only worked, but we were able to show that we could continue to get outcomes after graduation, which was really something that was important to us, that it wasn't just that they were doing because we sort of pushed them into it, but that they were still working and staying outside of mental health on their own. So just to give you a little bit of a taste of kind of what we know about our data. So this is a sample of people. It's data that's published in Psychiatric Services. And this is only including people who finished standard DBT and chose to go on to DBT ACEs. So I would not expect to get these outcomes if I included everybody who started standard DBT and went through, because many people don't choose to go on to DBT ACEs. We get maybe about half of them choosing to go on to DBT ACEs. Part of that is some people have medical complications that make returning to work to a substantial degree a problem, fibromyalgia or other kinds of illnesses, pain problems, disability problems. We also find there's some people who are just not interested in the stability and the remission of their symptoms that Jim was talking about is really what they want. They're really not interested in sort of taking on leaving the system. And what we found, especially for people who have been unable to work or disabled, you know, with Medicaid or Medicare, Social Security, whatever, for a long time, it's very, very difficult to unravel your relationship with the system. And for a lot of people, it's very, very threatening to do that, because their real fear, at least for a lot of our community mental health-oriented patients on who have a history of being homeless, is that this would happen again, that they would lose everything, that they would work, something would go wrong, they wouldn't be able to maintain their job, and they wouldn't be able to maintain their home, and they would lose everything and end up on the street. And I think that's a very genuine fear for a lot of people, especially people who don't have family or other safety nets for themselves. So in any case, that's a long story to saying that I do not want to make claims that we can get these kind of outcomes with just anybody who walks in the door. I'm talking about people who have been able to respond to DBT, which is the majority of our folks, and who choose to go into an employment model, which, like I said, not everyone does. But of the people who chose to do this, you can see that there was, looking on the slide that says clients competitively employed or enrolled in college or technical school, that of that crowd, about 10% had been working before they came to DBT. That's pretty typical for the Washington State population of folks with significant mental illness. And then about 43% of them were working by the end of standard DBT. So, you know, DBT does have really work-compatible skills in it, and so some people were able to work. But that jumped up pretty substantially to 70% in the year that they were in ACEs, and half of them were able to maintain that in their follow-up year. And these numbers are way above what you typically see for a community mental health population. We also are very interested in people competitively being competitively employed, and particularly living wage. That's really what our goal is, because essentially asking people to work where they're living in poverty or living at an income that's less than what disability would give them seems really an untenable plan. And when you first start working, you lose money. As many of you probably know, and your food stamps go down or your rent goes up or whatever, So people don't only kind of make somewhere between 28 and 48% of the money they earn at first, do they actually get because of these other entitlements that go down. So one of the things we're really interested in is how many people could we get working enough that the amount of income they're bringing in outweighs these other losses, and that they're working enough that a living wage job seems attainable to them and an ability to be off at least the cash payments or the family's financial support. And so you can see we had a pretty dramatic increase from 3% to 45% by the end of ACEs for those individuals, and again, they were able to sustain it. And we actually had a fair number of people who were working closer to 40 hours a week, a subset of these guys. The other thing we were very interested in is getting our patients out of public mental health services, primarily because they don't seem to really help. You have to remember that I'm on the West Coast in New Washington. There's very little psychotherapy available, especially for adult patients. There's more available for kids. And therefore, what you pretty much get in public mental health is case management medications, neither of which seem to be having a very strong effect for our patients. So our goal was to get them out of the public mental health system. We've seen after DBT and certainly after ACEs that many people actually do better outside of the system than in it, even if that means they have no care. So all of the time they were in treatment with us, they're 100% in public mental health services because we're defined as public mental health services in our community, but you can see that only 36% were still in public mental health services in the follow-up year. Sorry, I'm just checking my watch. Okay. We saw some improvement in people's life satisfaction. This is their subjective rating of their life satisfaction, but a large jump of that was from standard EBT, and that we also see in terms of things like the emergency room visits and inpatient admissions and medically treated self-inflicted injuries. All of those, I'm mostly documenting that they didn't go back up, but we all know those are our core treatment effects of a year of DBT, and that's what we see in our in our data as well. Okay, so now I'm on the slide that says formalizing DBT ACEs. So what we decided to do as we were kind of coming, by 2004 we had sort of a general shape of the treatment, and we decided to apply for funding from NIMH to do an R34 treatment development grant, as Jim was saying. And what that means is that we had a first draft of the manual. We had some pre-post data. And what we wanted was more as money to kind of more formalize it and be able to do more pilot rate data, be sure we could recruit people, complete assessment, do the treatment, have a control group, which is a big issue for us, is we'd never looked at what would be the appropriate control group. And when you have a treatment that's really as long as 2 years, coming up with the control group is actually very complicated because you can't just say usual care for 2 years or something like that. At this point, the idea of telling people they would not receive DBT for 2 years just seems totally untenable. So that's kind of where we got in terms of formalizing the treatment. So by 2008, we had the treatment that I'm going to describe to you now. So the most important thing to know about DBT ACEs is it's pretty much DBT. There's actually very little different between DBT ACEs and DBT, and that's always been done with intention. We're never really trying to create something really unique from DBT. So we have the same treatment hierarchy, same modes, meaning individual, group, phone, hustle team, same functions, same balance of acceptance and change, dialectical strategies. We actually use all the same treatment strategies, same focus on movement, speed, and flow in treatment. What is different is we have a very specific recovery goal, which is a life worth living outside of the social service system. In DBT ACEs, this means the ability to live successfully without continual psychosocial treatment and off psychiatric disability benefits despite life's inevitable setbacks. And I should actually update this slide. I missed that I've kind of reworked this because we, one of the ways our hospital decided to be depression-proof was to bring in commercial or private insurance for our DBT patients, as well as Medicaid and Medicare. Ironically, that actually was a way of kind of across the hospital, people who had specialty services that could bring in you know, standard insurance funding, that became kind of our focus, which is very unusual for a hospital like Harborview Medical Center, which is really the county hospital and really focused on the low-income safety net population. But with that, we've had a lot of folks who are coming in who are not on psychiatric disability through the state or the federal government, but they're functionally on psychiatric disability because their family is they're entirely financially dependent and often socially and emotionally dependent on their family. And so I've actually reworked this. I'll have to remember to fix that slide. So, the point I wanted to make about that is that this is part of why not everybody wants to do DBT ACEs and why it's not, you know, people often ask me about it as a, like, graduate treatment. It's really not a graduate treatment. It's really a unique treatment with a very specific focus, and it would not work well as something you just forced everybody to do. Leaving the systems, becoming independent, I personally think that DBT ACEs is easily as hard as standard DBT. It takes every bit as much time and effort on the clinician's part as well as the client's part. There's so many forces pushing on our clients to keep them disabled, to keep them away from recovery, that they have to learn to push back against. It's actually a way more complicated enterprise than we ever imagined. So just to give you kind of some specifics here, in terms of where we have adapted DBT, you can see that we use the same general DBT hierarchy, but in terms of targeting, we make the DBT ACEs recovery goals the highest priority for quality of life interfering behaviors, and we do this to be consistent with other DBT models like substance abuse or eating disorders or any other specialty where you always make that the highest quality of life interfering behavior target rather than replacing life-threatening or therapy-interfering behaviors. It's not actually sensible to replace those. Obviously, if somebody's going to die, it doesn't really matter whether they are going to work or not. And if they're not complying and participating in therapy or their therapist isn't is doing things that are interfering, nobody's going to get anywhere. So it makes very good sense to leave those as the highest priority. But we really are telling people that if they have other quality of life targets that are not the recovery goals, then this is not the program for them, so that they don't sign on and then end up in something they don't want. So we've developed, first we were just saying we had some very general ideas about what this is, and one of the things that we did as part of the R34 in collaboration with Marsha Linehan was to develop a list of targets. What do we actually mean that somebody needs to do? And I believe you have a PDF that Perry sent you that is a version of this self-assessment I give the clients periodically as part of an application and then all the way through the treatment year. But I kind of just tweaked it to talk about family members or people that you care about. So if you haven't had a chance to fill it out, I think it's incredibly helpful as a way of thinking and understanding really the complexity of what psychiatric disability really means. And I think it applies beyond borderline personality disorder, but this is where we've focused on it. So I've kind of modified the scale that you would typically see on a DBT ACEs, a standard DBT diary card in terms of how much they're using their skills, to kind of use that same 0 to 7 scale to think about how well they've managed to recover on each of these targets. And what we do in team is we actually gave up monthly because it was too much work. So we're now quarterly having team reviews. So the clients complete this self-assessment for themselves. They did it before they came into therapy. They do it every 3 months during therapy. They share it with their therapist, and their therapist shares with the team, and that way we can all keep ourselves on track. So let me just quickly run through these. So the first is our employment and getting off psychiatric disability goals specifically. So in order to really do this, you do need to choose a career path to living wage employment knowing its fit with your wise mind values and talents, as well as the practical issues of pay, health insurance, leave and retirement benefits, hours, shift times, training, certification, and routes to advancement. And we've added all of that because of a sort of hard experience. But also, I've been very conscious that people have talked a lot when you start using recovery language with folks with chronic mental illness or severe mental illness, people often start focusing on, you know, recovery is getting what you want, doing what makes you happy, et cetera. And I just think that's a little bit fragilizing. I don't think that's treating our clients the way we would treat anybody else, because it's not, we don't say to everybody else in our lives, your employment is just whatever works for you. Whatever's going to make you happy. And, you know, there's a lot of practical things that have to be dealt with. And if you don't deal with them, it's unlikely somebody could work a job in that was just what they wanted to do, but they couldn't necessarily support themselves with a living wage. We have lots of clients who are wonderful, wonderful artists, and we spend a lot of time talking about avocations and vocations and how can they maybe find a job for 20 hours a week at the state or Starbucks or somewhere that you get benefits for part-time work so that they can pursue their art. Often I had a patient who's beautiful, fun paintings of dogs, and she was getting nice commissions from kennels in town, dog washing places, people, and actually per hour it paid better than her job. But given her history not only with borderline personality disorder but also bipolar disorder, where she'd had a very severe manic break where she'd lost everything within the past few years, we talked about the fact that it's actually very hard to support yourself with health insurance unless you have some base to do it from. And so we worked a lot on what job she could do that was really just to pay the bills. And to me, that's treating our clients as we would anybody else, our nieces, our nephews, our children, our siblings, in terms of, you know, any advice we'd give to anybody. So we definitely want to see that they can, moving on to the next one, demonstrate capability to financially support themselves and their family, if they have other people to support, in their chosen career without psychiatric disability or partner family income, but also to demonstrate capability to financially support themselves and their family in at least one fallback job. And this is often a real area of contention with our clients, is that we make them go and practice working just any job. But it's a very, very fundamental, it's become incredibly core to DBT ACEs, is that if you're really going to avoid homelessness, you have to know that if you lost your job, you could hit the pavement, you could find a job fast, and you could work it so that you could keep paying your bills and not end up on the street. And that ability to find a job fast, to stay focused on that process, to get a job, to live with an employer you hate, until you can find something better, is an incredibly important skill. And most of my patients have really no track record with this. They've either were fine in jobs where they had benign bosses and they lost the job for some other reason, or they've been able to sustain themselves in a job with a difficult employer. And that's kind of, again, what we all have to do in order to keep ourselves off disability. We need to make sure they have sufficient health insurance to maintain their health care and their medications, even if they're not in a new psychotherapy, which is kind of our goal. And we want them to have better than 90% follow-through at work on attendance, being on time, appropriate dress and manner, following directions, job tasks, et cetera. And it is core to me, and I know to the rest of our team, and I think it becomes core to our patients as well. This is not about getting a job in which you're sitting off in the corner, you're not getting fired, but you never get a raise, you never get a promotion, you never get attention, you're not part of the community. That's a disaster for our patients. That is so socially disconnected. It's an incredibly aversive experience for people who go to a job where they're not part of things, or go to a job where other people are getting promoted and they are not. So it's a very important focus for us that they can really fall through and be able to achieve at work. Related to that is interpersonal proficiency. So I go to the next slide. Right, we want them to be interpersonally easy to be with, even with difficult people, even when they're stressed out. The ability to regulate their emotional expression and actions and find wise mind in all different interpersonal situations. to know their wise mind personal limits and act on them. This is really critical because actually DBT skills are wonderful job skills. And often when I get people to work within the first 4 months of ACEs, they discover it's a lot easier than they thought it would be. And, in fact, their employers really like them. And then they get assigned way more. Like they're getting too many shifts. They're getting asked to do lots of extra things. And then they don't know how to say no, or they're just so darn excited that everybody likes them. They say yes to everything, and then they get completely overwhelmed. And if you don't keep a very close eye out, we'll kind of have an extreme moment and quit. So we take this very seriously. And like I said before, I want them to be receiving praise, raises, promotions, offers for more desirable jobs and roles within their own community. In terms of life outside of work, these are not distinct. These are just things that one person could satisfy more than one category here. But that we want them to have at least a couple of local or long-distance friends whose values align with theirs, have at least a person or group for casual interactions, like who could I eat lunch with, people at church, who could I go to coffee with, Seattle, that's what we do here, book club, volunteer organizations, you know, that those casual interactions, that being part of a group is really fundamental, especially for people with a long depression history. They have at least one close support with whom they experience intimacy and discuss private issues who is not their therapist, and they have at least one local person or group who would take notice if they were not around and would take action to find them. And again, I really see this coming for people who've had, you know, more than three episodes of depression. They're likely to have further episodes of depression, and often if you're not integrated with a community, nobody notices you're gone until you've been gone a long time, and you can kind of sink deeper and deeper. And people who are well connected with their community have people who kind of chase them, and I think that's really critical. In terms of life outside of work, we want them to be an active member of an organized recreational activity that's either fun or meaningful and not related to mental health. That they disengage from relationships with family members that are ineffective or destructive. And by disengage, we don't necessarily mean end. You notice I say disengage or end friendships that are ineffective or destructive. You know, family, you know, one of our core views about family is this is, that's not unique to ACEs, I think it's just a DBT perspective, that this is the relationship that goes on forever. You had it at the beginning, and your mother's your mother's, you're always is your mother. And that disengagement may be necessary. So I have clients who they've just worked it out that they go to restaurants with their family because nobody seems to do well when somebody's in somebody else's home. And they do fine when they go to a restaurant. And that's how they do it. And that works for them. And so, you know, if some people who just don't keep up with family as often as their family would like to, or they negotiate some kind of truce around certain topics that won't be discussed, et cetera. To choose relationships based on evidence that they're compatible in their lifestyles, needs, and values. So a lot of my patients do not know how to look at evidence as to whether somebody's a good fit, that they need to take steps to find effective, rewarding relationships if they want to. And then we have our self-sufficiency list. So these are all the things that we all have to worry about. Managing our monthly budget, having savings, especially our goal, not everybody gets there, but our goal is for people to have 3 months of living expenses ready to go. So if they were losing their job, they have at least a 3-month window to find another one before they would be in trouble. But also savings for things they would like to do and to get themselves out of debt or get their debt down to a reasonable level. I think we're all trying to do that now. Have an effective method for managing their time. So making sure their time fits their values, that they get key things done on time, but also that it balances leisure, household, and downtime. And this is something that I can tell you as somebody who runs a DBT ACEs group, we work on at least every third week. It's really a challenge for my clients. That they have a way of preventing their psychiatric symptoms from impacting their functioning. They may not be able to prevent them. I have some clients who are depressed or anxious or have psychotic symptoms. They can't necessarily stop them, but they need to be able to prevent them from impacting their functioning and have an effective method for managing chronic illness or pain problems to minimize its impact as well. And lastly, we have the emotional proficiency, so they have to be able to experience negative emotions, building, staying, falling without acting on them. Same thing with positive emotions, and to be able to reduce problematic emotions effectively and fast enough to prevent them from leading to problems. So you can see we have quite a challenging list of things to do, and that's why ACEs is not something that should be taken lightly. It does take a full year of pretty steady work to make big progress on this. So just to kind of demonstrate, we've edited our diary card. So the front of the diary card is the one with the mountain with the little flag on top that I got from Tony DeBose. You can see that we're pretty unstructured about what the we keep track of suicide and self-harm. I actually now should put my newer version of this. I've moved those down to the bottom of the list just to convey that we are tracking it for safety and security, but we're not expecting it to be the dominant thing. And then we have the back of the diary card, which is the one that says ACEs, strategies, and productivity. So it's not really the back, it's sort of the bottom half of the card. I wanted it to print big enough so that you could see it, so I sort of cut the card in half. So you can see that we don't have them checking off DBT skills per se, but we've tried to take those recovery goals and turn them into something you can actually rate over the course of the week. And also, you can see on the upper right-hand corner from your calendar where we're trying to encourage them to track all of this in a day planner, calendar, you know, time management organization. Please look at that and then give us some totals on how much they've done each of these things. And, of course, when they're looking for work, we're going to be not expecting to see that they've got a job, but we're expecting to see lots of applications submitted and interviews, contacts about jobs. Obviously, when they're working, those fall away. And then a box to just describe the different things they did that way during the week. So the rest of the adaptations I can go through pretty quickly. So there's an adaptation of the skills curriculum where we specifically ask them to check in on a goal, the target, how they're getting there, what progress they've made, what they've done to it's effective to reach the target, what they've done to avoid, what emotion they've observed. There's more detail here. I won't spend a lot of time on it. But essentially, we're trying to teach them to be their own therapists and to be able to see for themselves what are the effective strategies that are working, what are the things that are not working. I actually stole the effective thing from Weight Watchers, where the fact that people go in every meeting and that everybody's lost weight is asked what's working for them means that people hear the same effective strategies over and over again, and it becomes harder and harder not to do the effective strategies of writing it down or drinking your water or whatever, watching your portions, if that's what all the successful people tell you they're doing. But I decided that we had a much more closed setting, and we could also directly target what ways they are avoiding it. And by avoid, I don't mean doing anything on purpose. I mean just like all the sneaky things that can come along and derail us, like forgetting it or prioritizing other things or getting caught up or getting overwhelmed or just, you know, getting willful, et cetera. And then we review homework and teach new material. So jumping to adaptation to skills curriculum slide with the white box, you can just see what the curriculum is. So we do go over the DBT skills one more time. So you can see August is mindfulness and October is emotion regulation, December is distress tolerance, and January is interpersonal skills. And that's not using the original handouts. They've all done that twice. It's all applying it, and then it's applying DBT skills to lots of other areas, anxiety management, to time management, depression management. We work a lot directly on perfectionism. We have a nice module on what we call succeeding in usual care, which is figuring out how to deal with non-DBT-oriented clinicians who might be very scared of looking at your history and your diagnosis, and how can you interact with them in a way that makes them feel comfortable in not kind of sending you to an emergency room every time you have a bad day or whatever. And the other thing that's really different in ACEs is that we have found that without contingencies to work, our clients plan to work and plan to work and plan to work and frequently never work. And after kind of going through a number of years of this, one of my colleagues, Cindy Sanderson, said, well, you know, in our day treatment program, if you don't start working, we tell you you can't stay. And that was like an eye-opening idea. And I went back and I told my team, and we were like, oh, my God, we had never even thought of, like, doing that. So it really, that contingency changed everything for us, everything. I just think it's too hard to do if you don't have contingencies. So in standard EBT, we get them started on this by getting them to do what we call normative and productive activities or getting active. And they have to start doing that up to 10 hours a week in those first 4 months. And from 4 to 8 months, they do it for 10 hours, working up to 15. And then you can see from 15, working up to 20, because we don't want somebody going to work who hasn't even been getting active out of the house in general. So that we define getting and staying active as things that are normative. That is, you act as if you don't have emotional problems around other people who act as if they don't have emotional problems. So like hanging out in our drop-in lounge is not does not count because our drop-in lounge is really meant for people with mental illness, and everybody there does not try to do anything to act particularly functional in that environment. And so it's a place where our patients could easily be encouraged to be symptomatic. And this is just, it's just not a contingency for health. The other thing is that they need to be productive. So we talk about that as structured, active, goal-oriented, rewarding, and outside of the mental health system. And there's a kind of wide range of things. So we want to just get them moving in standard DBT to be ready for DBT ACEs. In DBT ACEs, they have a career plan requirement, or what we generally call career activities. So by 4 months into ACEs, they have to maintain things that are going to get them living wage career. So that could be working. It could also be college or vo-tech training. There's like a certification for everything now. I have a client who wants to be a medical clinic receptionist. She has to go through a whole certification program for that. Or self-employment, and they have to do that up to 10 hours into ACEs, and then up to, by 8 months, they have to be doing it 20 hours. Given that we're doing ACEs, there's actually quite a lot of commuting it takes to get in and out of my clinic because we're sort of downtown, that a lot of people have health problems, children, other things. We never require more than 20 hours a week of anybody's time, so these 20 hours essentially replace the 20 hours of getting active. They're not added to them. Many of our folks do end up working and going to school more than 20 hours a week, but we don't require that because, you know, other people, you know, people do have complex commitments in their lives. The other thing that's usually our biggest controversy with our clients is what we call our work as therapy requirement. Essentially, we need to know that they can function effectively in a standard, very, very standard workplace. So during standard DBT or in ACEs, they have to spend 6 months working at least 10 hours a week at a typical competitive employment job for an employer who files a they get a W-2, but you file a W-9, whatever it is. But the point is, it's not under the table, it's not self-employment, it's not contract work. We want to know, can you just go get a job if you have to? We also want to know that you could get a job fast. So they have 4 months into ACEs to have met this requirement, and they have one of the things we instituted with the recession, because we were starting to worry that it would be very hard for them to get jobs, since other people weren't getting jobs either, and other people had job histories, was that they had to put in an increasing number of job applications. So it's once a week the first month of ACEs, 5 the second month, 10 the third month, and by the fourth month of ACEs, they need to be putting out 15 applications a week, and it cannot just be 15 things on Craigslist, because Craigslist is like it's almost nobody gets a job that way, let's just say. They have to actually go pound the pavement or do whatever. And that's usually pretty contentious. People really don't want to do it, but you really learn so many skills in being under high pressure to find a job, and that's what it's like if you are off disability and you don't have a way of supporting yourself and you lose a job. So we're trying to mimic that. And then they have to maintain, of course, standard DBT requirements. So they can't be suicidal, have a lot of therapy-differing behavior, and they have to stay active. And then individual therapy is really the same as individual therapy and regular DBT. There's a couple notes about how we do things differently, but it's not really very different. Coaching is the same, except if we started to have to coach suicidal behavior, that would actually be a big problem for us, that they couldn't manage that on their own. They're told that to come to ACEs, they have to be able to manage crisis situations on their own with their own skills. And so the last thing, just to show you a couple of graphs, one of the things that did not go well with our pilot study was that when Marcia and I were trying to figure out how to do a two-year treatment with a grant that's 3 years with $150,000 a year in funding, the treatment I was trying to do and the funding did not align well, let's just say. And so one of the things we did was we said we would give everybody standard DBT and they'd be randomized at 12 months to either get ACEs or to see what we called enhanced standard care. Essentially, it was our community mental health services provided at our agency, but they got individual weekly therapy with their primary case manager, clinician, mostly supportive therapy. Some people did some CBT stuff in there. But we made sure they got weekly services, and then they could go to groups, employment services, everything. Oh, and they also got, everybody got an evaluation by the employment specialist, so they could get good information about disability, about job options in the traditional supported employment model that the rest of my agency uses. And this turned out to be a disaster. NIMH also wanted us to make sure that the DBT clients also had to change therapists, because otherwise we'd have this big confound that half of them had to change therapists and half of them didn't. So we changed therapists within the DBT team if they got randomized to DBT. So they had a different person for ACEs than they did for the first year, and then the enhanced standard care people. The outcomes of the people who finished standard DBT and DBT ACEs were excellent, but 80% of them dropped out. I don't think you can change therapists that way. I don't think you can really divide this treatment into 2 years. This is why I'm grateful that NIMH gave me a treatment development study so that I could actually figure this out without the pressure of a full study. Although if I had a full study, I probably wouldn't have designed it this way. But in any case, what we also were interested in is what actually happens for people who do go on to enhanced standard care. There's been a sort of a question of what happens if you have 1 year of DBT and then go back to community mental health from, and all of these folks were very stable. They'd successfully completed standard DBT. They did not have any crisis behaviors anymore. They were doing actually quite well. And so we just did kind of a multiple baseline. We only had 9 people. But I just want to kind of highlight what we were seeing. So if you look at this graph, each line represents a person. There aren't as many lines as there are actually 9 lines there. Some of them are just people who never tried to work at all, and then they're just on top of each other on the 0 line. But you can see that a lot of people kind of got going in the right direction with work during the standard DBT year. A couple of people kind of tried to jump ahead when they went to standard care. But it kind of, for most people, there was kind of a fall-off. It just did not seem to, even though we talked about it a lot in standard DBT, it did not seem to kind of keep itself going in standard care. It did look like, this is a graph of the difficulties in emotion regulation, or DERS scale, and their DBT skills scores. This is just looking to see kind of how are they doing symptomatically. And what we see is that everybody, you know, except for 2 people, had pretty steady falls in their difficulty in emotional regulation. In other words, they were regulating better. But then that sort of decline kind of flattened. So it's like they got as far as they got, and when they went on to enhanced standard care, which is essentially community mental health care, they didn't get much, a couple of them got worse, but they definitely didn't get better. They did learn a lot in terms of their DBT skills, so we gave them a pre-test, and then we tested them at 12 months, and then after a year of enhanced standard care. And people had some fall off, but I actually thought it wasn't bad, given that they'd spent a year of not talking about skills. Instances of self-injury, unfortunately, kind of reappeared for a number of people in enhanced standard care that we did not see in the ACEs, and we don't generally see in ACEs. And quality of life was kind of all over the map. So we really didn't have any pattern to make up from that. So part of what we're, you know, it's a very small sample, but it definitely doesn't suggest that it's all going to be, you know, flowers and roses if people do a year of standard DBT and then transfer to standard services. So our current steps are planning in an AMH randomized controlled trial. We're doing it with Harbor UCLA, which is Harbor UCLA and a place in Germany are really the only places that are doing DBT ACEs at this point, but Harbor UCLA has started using the model. We gave them a pretty thorough training, and we've given a pretty thorough training to the German folks as well. And so we're planning a study with them. We've since done some revisions to the skills curriculum. I have to actually force myself to stop, make any changes. So now I'm just trying to write the teaching notes on that. And then we're also trying to pilot an 18-month version where we do 6 months of standard DBT and then do ACEs for people where we set it up differently. Like, so when you come into standard DBT now, you don't commit to ACEs at all. You just commit to standard DBT, and then somewhere during the standard DBT year, your therapist lets you know that ACEs exist and asks if you want to do it, and if so, you apply for it, et cetera, as a sort of a separate program. And a lot of people have been saying, you know, what about just having people who are a little maybe more stable than your patients just come and do the whole thing? You know, they do 6 months of DBT, so they know enough DBT to do ACEs, and we'll just give it a try. And I've been a little skeptical about it, and we're definitely having some mixed success with it, but we've just kind of gotten started with a few cases, so we'll see how that goes, because it might be nice to, you know, we've always taken very highly suicidal, pretty disabled folks into our program, and just by the nature of that's how our program runs, and so that's who we have data on. And we'd like to see if we take in a more stable group of folks who want to work and run them through an 18-month protocol, how effective is that? And that's the end of my talk. I'm happy to take questions.
Wow, thank you. I'm trying to organize these things. The questions that several people refer to, we have, just in this Washington area, it's a challenge to even find one DBT therapist, and this is a sophisticated large market. So the two people want to know, if we can't find a therapist to do as a family member, could we do this?
It's actually an interesting question. I think there's some definite pieces that you could do. The check-in is, which I didn't spend a lot of time on, but there's kind of a check-in worksheet. That's pretty straightforward, sort of problem-solving. I would say probably better than 50-60% of the handouts. You could probably just sit down and work through with your family member, and that would probably be helpful. You'd have to think about how you would want to set up contingencies, like if they aren't applying for jobs or they aren't doing things, you know, what would the actual consequence of that be? Because like I said, this is just one of those things that people avoid. I think we know that is true for many people who are discouraged and they're dropping out of the unemployment market now. So that would be the thing I would think would be more challenging, but I think it's a really good idea. If there's a way to do it, I really think you should try it. And I'm happy to consult with anybody who wants to try it.
Oh, well, that's an offer. It would be hard to refuse then. The other question from a therapist here says, this really looks like I'd have to make a real, as they put it, have to make a real big shift in what I do. DP kind of fits within what I'm familiar with and trained with and do, and this is really kind of nitty-gritty of daily life.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that it is a shift. I think I had a conversation about this with the folks at UCLA, because one of the things is we are really demanding a lot of the patients, and we got to that point slowly over about 10 years of upping what we asked from them and upping what we asked from them and upping, and they kept meeting our, and we just kept getting more and more and more and more. So the LA people have told me, yeah, it's quite an experience to kind of shift internally what you're doing. And one thing they decided to do was they were also not limiting their standard DBT to 1 year, which I kind of felt they should, given they have like a year's waiting list or something, to get in there. And it gets, you know, that's the reason we were always a year, is partly with Marcia's data, but also we have to keep our front door as open as we possibly can. So they just decided that they would have a year sort of prepping themselves and the clients for ACEs before they actually started. And so they told all of their clients a year ago, September, so it would be September 2011, that they were, this was their last year, if they were in for more than 1 year, or if they were new, that this would be 1 year, and that they would have the option of applying for DBT ACEs if they were benefiting from DBT. And so their ACEs group started, and they had their first, I think, five or so people go into the ACEs program in October, and I think that was actually a very strategic move for them. I think that really helped. All the therapists had some time to wrap their brain around the implications of things before they had to do it.
Yeah, my therapist here says, he says, I can't think of handing this off to someone else based on your experience, that didn't work well. So if I get into a borderline client doing this, I'm really aiming for buying a whole big package to be really successful.
You know, I think that that's the only thing I've ever studied. It's possible that if you took just pieces of it, like the requirement to go to work, or just keeping the focus of your therapy on those recovery goals instead of what you would normally do, or you know, things like that, it may be that you get a bump from that. We've just never studied it, so we don't know if you do part of ACEs whether you get what kind of effect you get.
Okay, I'm going to try to group. I hope I satisfy everybody with this. People can see a number of reasons that their family member with BPT might not be successful. For example, one says, with the medications I take for depression, I've gained so much weight that really kind of precludes the social life. Another one says, their family member is so anxious in new situations that they just kind of withdraw behind the curtains and are cut off. And the third one says it kind of plunges into relations. It's the, you know, walking on eggshells of everything being, oh, this is terrific and so forth, and plunges into relationships, sexual relationships and so forth, and then whoops, hey, it's not, I really didn't know what I was getting into, and then we have backing off and conflict. I guess those are.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of what we kind of work through in the program for sure. You know, I would say that the main ways that DBT ACEs works is that it's exposure, that people are very frightened of new social situations, of applying for jobs, going to school, etc. There really is a lot of fear, and a lot of that fear, actually, if you've learned DBT skills, is not actually justified. It's amazing how much more successful, I mean, we would say, I would think it's about 20% of people, maybe less than that, who get a job as part of ACEs and then lose it. Well, I would say yes, it's definitely less than that for actually being fired. I don't even think 10% of our clients are fired. I would say maybe 20. One in five or so will just say, I hate this job and quit it. But it's amazing how much the fact that they knew the DBT skills before they came in and they had a therapist to help them, these people are amazingly successful, and I see that happen socially as well. It's like you learn this set of skills, but you haven't, like, challenged yourself to really see what those skills could do for you, and that's kind of what ACEs is, and I really feel like that's more about DBT skills that they learned in the first year. But we have to push them to actually try it. And that's where the contingencies, if you don't have a deadline, for a lot of folks, they just wouldn't do it. And because it's just so hard and so scary. So I think that that's absolutely true. And that's why I think some people don't choose to take this on. I think on the other side of it is, I didn't really talk about our application. We have an application, it's quite a large process, actually, for applying to DBT ACEs, and we do it because, in part, it is a process that gets them thinking about things that are going to be really relevant before they come to ACEs, and I think helps them decide, is this really what I want? I think that people could make an impulsive decision to do ACEs and hate it. So, you know, we've kind of put a whole process of applying. It usually takes people about 2 months, maybe three in some cases, to kind of get through the whole process. So that's what the end of standard DBT is like. And I think it's an important part of not making impulsive moves. I think that all can kind of help as well.
Yeah, that can be challenging for a parent, or really got to have a longer time frame to work all this through and not kind of have closure to let's go and do something right away.
It's the process of going to work and being financially and socially independent. I just had a patient who graduated a month ago, and we look back and we're like, whoa, where did the time go? And, you know, she was not working at all. She had a long-term relationship, but wasn't working. And then now she's working at the Gap. She's in school. She's doing this medical receptionist certification program that you need to do in order to get a job in that field. Her relationship with her partner is, like, vastly improved. He came to her graduation. And he said she'd totally changed. Her relationship with other people is much improved. Like, we changed a lot of stuff, and it actually seems kind of fast, but when you look at it at the front end and you think that it was 2 years, more than that considering the time you found a DBT program and then for us to get through standard DBT and then to do ACEs, this is where we've been piloting a shorter program, and part of me is thinking, I don't know if we can do it, because it does take a lot in standard DBT to kind of help shape somebody to be ready to do this. And I think that's something we underestimated, Marcia and I, when we planned the NIMH grant, and we thought we could just randomly assign people at the halfway point. You know, when I'm going back in, I'm going to go in for a full 2-year model of DBT plus DBT ACEs and compare it to 2 years of standard DBT. Because I just don't think you can split the year. I think you need that much time to go through this process.
Jim? Kate?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, okay. I don't know if Jim was finished with his questions. Jim? I guess maybe we lost him.
Well, I noticed that we're past the hour, so
yeah,
maybe
something must have happened. Kate, thank you so much. Knowing
you're very welcome.
So long ago, to finally be able to see it as an entire package is really wonderful. You know, also would be interested in talking with you about what you think family members could do with this, because as you know, we have our Family Connections program. So if there's some way we could be doing something with this too, we'd be honored to work with you on it.
Oh, that'd be fun. I'm really curious, actually. I'd never even thought of that. I'd be very curious to see what happens. I'll also shoot you the website where people can go and see the rest of my full manual and materials and stuff like that.
Oh, that would be great.
Register, and then once you're registered, you get access to, like, the copies of the manual and everything. I'll just shoot that to you. If you want to share that with people, then if they would like to go see it, then there's a little more material there.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. And thank you for giving your time. And we know it's
Absolutely.
Still not even dinner there yet for you, so have a nice dinner.
Okay, thank you.
All right,
take care, guys.
Be well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.